The next case on our oral argument calendar is number A-19-5, State of Minnesota versus Stephen Wayne Culver. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin. Please identify yourself at the beginning of your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Sarratori, S-A-R-R-A-T-O-R-I, and I represent the appellant in this matter, the defendant in the lower court action, Stephen Wayne Culver. I'm here today arguing that the district court abused its discretion in sending Mr. Culver to prison, albeit a presumptive prison sentence of 172 months, by ignoring the numerous factors that were provided regarding Mr. Culver and a dispositional departure. I will begin by saying that this is a very tough case. When we look at our careers and we look at cases that we've endured, criminal sexual conduct cases having to do with children is very tough, very emotional, because they shock the conscience. But that emotion cannot cloud the judgment of the people, the professionals that are taxed with making decisions and defending the people in these cases. And it's arguable that the lower court abused its discretion by ignoring the factors. And when I look at why we point to that, or why the appellant is pointing to a possible abuse of discretion and clouded judgment, is the actions of the lower court judge throughout the transcript in this matter. If you look at the definition of discretion, it is when it is said that something is left to the discretion of a judge, it signifies that he or she ought to decide according to the rules of equity and the nature of the circumstances, a liberty or privilege allowed to a judge within the confines of right and justice. It's arguable that that has been compromised here in this case.
Would you go ahead.
Can we assume that the district court read the PSI?
I'm not assuming. I'm going by the judge's statements that she did read everything, which was pointed out in the sentencing itself.
Isn't reading the PSI enough of a consideration for a district court judge to make a determination?
It may if the court looked at all the factors. Okay, when I'm saying looking at consideration, the court blatantly said within minutes of conclusions of arguments, I'm sending you to prison. Okay, that's it. You're going to prison for 172 months. You're going today, and that's it. Okay? During the sentencing portion of the procedure or the hearing, the court admonished the defendant. The court ignored his acceptance of responsibility. The court ignored at least seven factors that Trog, our seminal case here, looks at for why somebody or why a district court should depart. When you're looking at a departure that's based upon or asking for a dispositional departure, you look at the individual. McAllister says that.
Page 62 of the transcript did say, I will grant you that Mr. Culver has been respectful. He's quiet when he's here. I'll grant you that he's not violated any conditions of his release. And I'll grant you that he followed through with the meetings required of him in the examination. So the judge at least did consider some of those factors that you wanted her to consider.
Well, did she? I mean, why not depart then? You have seven factors here. You have cooperation. This comes from Trog. You have cooperation, facts. She acknowledged he's cooperative. From Trog, acceptance of responsibility. She accepted the plea, but then turns around and says, I don't believe you. You can't have it both ways. He pled guilty. District Court Judge Street accepted the plea, but then during sentencing says, I don't believe you. How do you have it both ways? Should have never accepted the plea if she could not believe what he's saying. Amenability to probation. Court acknowledged he's amenable.
But hold on a minute. The district court, when they accepted the plea, didn't have the pre-sentence investigation.
She had the facts.
But she didn't have the pre-sentence investigation.
The pre-sentence...
Which is what the district court relies on to a great extent. And in that pre-sentence investigation, it set out a lot of factors as to why the presumptive sentence was appropriate.
The pre-sentence investigation done by probation takes into consideration many things. But one of the things they will do, and you will see in 99%, and I don't have the exact figures here, is they will recommend the presumptive sentence. Very rarely do PSIs recommend a departure.
Well, isn't that what the sentencing guidelines want, is consistency in sentencing?
Yes, we would love that. We would love consistency in sentencing, but also the sentencing guidelines takes into consideration a non-exhaustive list of reasons why a district court should depart. And if those, if there's more than seven factors why the district court should depart, and factually there was, the court acknowledged that. The question is in her discretion, why did she not depart in this case? Clearly, it's an abuse of discretion characterized by a clouded judgment based upon the emotion of the case. If you look at the statement on page 63, lines 10 through 13, the court clearly was applying the wrong standard in viewing this case. The district court judge states, and I quote, "And that's what keeps popping back into my head today. Because I keep thinking to not send you to prison would unduly depreciate the seriousness of your crime." That is not what the court needs to look at in a dispositional departure. It needs to look at the individual. That comes straight from McAllister. That comes straight from Trog. That comes straight from the sentencing guidelines. The court was looking at it more as a durational departure, which looks at the crime itself. It's also looking at Austin when a probation violation occurs, which says, if I don't violate your probation and confine you, I'm unduly appreciating the seriousness of the crime you have pled to and have been convicted. The district court judge was clearly looking at the crime itself, the emotion of the situation, and not looking at Mr. Culver, who demonstrated through professional evaluations, Dr. Alsdorf and others, that this person was messed up emotionally, mentally, but he's amenable to probation, low recidivism, support of family, a productive member of society today. He had a job. He's got a new family. He has support from friends and family. I've just given you seven factors that Trog says you only need one to show that somebody's amenable to probation.
Let's get back to the standard of review. It's an abuse of discretion. And so if the judge had departed, then opposing counsel would be arguing that she abused her discretion. I can't think of a case where a judge has imposed a guideline sentence where we say it's an abuse of discretion.
And, Your Honor, I understand that, and I acknowledge that. I mean, this is not an easy battle. This is an uphill battle here today, and I can acknowledge that. I'm not going to parse words. And you're right. There isn't cases where a presumptive sentence has been overturned. I haven't found one. If there's one out there, I've missed it.
I'm pretty sure you would have found it.
I'm sure I would have. I've quoted a lot of cases. But what I'm trying to say, which may be the difference here in this case, was the tenor of the sentencing hearing. Now, granted, it's emotional, as I started out saying here today, and we're all human.
But to Judge Smith's point, we have a pre-sentence investigation report that's fairly thorough, and then we have the psychosexual from Acumen.
Correct.
Which also was fairly thorough.
We also have the psychosexual from Dr. Alsdorf,
right,
which we arguably was very thorough as well.
And she considered all of those.
She stated she considered all those, and we got to take her for face value at saying that she considered all those. But then we look at the statements made during the sentencing hearing, the statement that I just made, the quote, about unduly depreciating the seriousness of the offense. The fact that she tried to interrogate my client with regards to how many times this happened. There was many, you know, there was a few swear words thrown in there during the sentencing. Again, not saying that that's a problem, but what I'm saying is to look and say why the discretion of the judge, or the way the lower court judge abused her discretion, is the fact that the emotion, the heinousness of the crime clouded her judgment in considering the factors that were present. And that's the present, and that's the argument that we're making as to why it is our position that the district court abused her discretion in sending him to prison when all of these factors were present.
So I was gonna, you say that there's record support for amenability to probation. Is that because of his behavior on conditional release? Is that what you're pointing to in the record?
Among a few other things, there was the court said that he has never violated probation. There's a lack of criminal history, which is another factor. He has zero criminal history, so there wasn't really any past behavior on probation that we could look to. But lack of criminal history actually is another factor that helps with regards to Mr. Culver. The other thing is that we look for is the low risk of recidivism that was quoted by Dr. Alsdorf. And put into his evaluation. We also look at the fact that when Mr. Culver was asked to do any evaluation, when he was asked to do anything that the court asked him or that he was ordered to do, he did it, okay? It shows a person who is willing to follow direction, willing to do what is asked of him. He showed up on time. He was always neatly dressed. He was respectful to the court. These are all factors that are looked at for amenability to probation. Again, we don't have a history of Mr. Culver, so we don't know how he was going to act on probation. We do know that he's a productive member of society. Again, at least I think I've said at least seven factual reasons that were acknowledged by the court for why under Trog to support a departure.
But Trog was an affirmance of a departure.
Pardon me?
That was an affirmance of a departure, Trog.
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding.
What I'm saying is that we have to look at a standard of review.
Oh, you said
here.
Affirmance. I thought you said something else. Yeah, I apologize.
And I just have a hard time figuring how the district court erred here.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but to Judge Riley's point, if it was the other way around, Mr. Yount would be arguing the same thing. You said, an affirmance of the district court. Well, Trog, presumably, they argued the same thing. The person who lost came in and said, the judge in Trog abused their discretion, okay? And the court said, well, no, you only need one factor. And even screwing up on probation, even testing positive for drug, wherever the case may be, it would still be enough to depart. In looking at this case, arguably, or maybe we all acknowledge that it's the type of case that we're looking at here. But that's the problem, okay? Yes, it's the type of case is considered, but that's considered in the guideline sentence, okay? This type of case is tough. We all acknowledge that. And to say that the judge abused her discretion by sending somebody to prison who acknowledged that he raped a child is arguably tough. But the simple fact is we've got to separate ourselves from that emotion, and that was not done here. It's clear by the record that was not done here, and it clouded the lower court's decision-making. That's why we're making our argument for abuse of discretion, and that goes to what the court even said on page 63. They looked more at the case itself, the facts of the case, the crime, not at the individual, which is what they are mandated to do, to look at the individual. And that's why we are saying that the court abused its discretion because its judgment was clouded based upon the facts of this case.
You say in your brief that he is extremely remorseful for his actions. Where in the record is that demonstrated?
Well, number one, he accepted responsibility and pled guilty. Okay. Number two, he has expressed, and I don't have it in front of me right here, but in the PSI, I believe in a couple of this, in the psychosexuals, he acknowledged that he feels so bad for his son, or his adoptive son. He had said that. The court didn't acknowledge that because the court said they didn't believe Mr. Culver. And the other issue we have, which was acknowledged in the professionals, is that he is struggling finding who he is. His emotional, his mental stunt of whatever's going on with him is part of the reason why he has such a hard time realizing what has gone on. Now, no, he doesn't amount to the fact of a Rule 20 or not be insane, but he does have a diminished capacity to appreciate the seriousness. With that being said, I see my time. I would ask that the court reverse the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Yount, counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court and opposing counsel. The sole question in this case today is simple and narrow. Did the district court abuse its broad discretion by imposing a presumptive guideline sentence? And it is black letter law that appellate courts may not interfere with the imposition of a guideline sentence if the sentencing court carefully evaluated the testimony information presented to it. Now, to Judge Riley's point, I'm not aware of a case that has flipped the imposition of a guideline sentence based on the arguments or the types of arguments presented here. And given this record, showing that the court carefully considered the information presented before it and that the record supports a guideline sentence, this court should affirm the guideline sentence here. Now, beginning with the first point, showing that the court considered the information presented, in a very literal, material way, the record shows that this court evaluated all the information before it. So on pages 2 and 3 of the transcript, for example, you have the sentencing court asking counsel, have I received all these documents that I have with me today? Is this the record? Counsel agrees. You then have 50-some-odd pages of the transcript, including 3 victim statements and testimony. And then in addition to that, you have argument by opposing counsel and both private attorneys on behalf of Mr. Culver. And then, even on page 55 and 56, you have the court noting, again, in a very tangible way, I've highlighted, I've made post-it notes, I've flagged, I've read it all, counsel. And my conclusion, in my discretion, is that you're going to prison in the presumptive sentence. So in a very basic...
And when did that statement occur? Mr. Sartori suggests it was at the beginning of the hearing, early on.
It was, Your Honor. And the court, if you read it in context, the court says, just so everyone knows where this is going and we don't have to wait till the end, she makes her decision and then she explains it.
Well, so then, I mean, I see. Was that before the arguments were made?
No, it was after. So you have a record showing that the court heard oral argument, heard the victim testimony and statements, and the court reviewed all the documents produced to the court. And then the court, in beginning to make its record of its decision, it states at the front saying, before I go any further, just so everyone knows, he is going to prison. Here's the reasons why. So that's what the transcript shows. And to that point and to Judge Smith's point, I mean, you have specific sites in the record. So for example, on page 59, the court specifically cites pages out of the PSE, the Acumen PSE, and the PSI, necessarily indicating that she had read them and that she had marked them up. So you have a court stating on the record, as is appropriate and is recommended, that she has read all of the record and the information and documents produced. And within her discretion, her conclusion from those documents is that a guideline sentence is most appropriate. And the court doesn't just stop there. She also makes a rather thoughtful and methodical record of how she is weighing those factors that she is giving due consideration to. And so, for example, you see the court focusing first on the victims and the impact that this has. I mean, she had 3 victims at the sentencing court that day. She had the child victim, the victim's mother, and the victim's stepfather. And all 3 testified to the horrific impact that this had in their lives, and all 3 asked for the maximum sentence available. And quite frankly, the sentencing court was understandably sensitive to that. You then have the court address the offender-related variables and the factors as is recommended by Trog and its progeny. You have the court looking at or acknowledging that while opposing counsel made good arguments and argued the motion well, she did not agree with it. She could not see in the record that he had evidenced remorse. There was a lack of remorse shown in the documents and in the case itself. And so, for example, in the PSI and the Ecumen PSE and his own Alsdorf PSE, you have him refusing to take responsibility for the alleged actions and for his criminal acts. He refuses to grapple with realities of what he had done to those around him. And I think the easiest way to sum it up is in his own PSE that he went, his third-party PSE that he was referred to. It concluded on page 7 of the document, he appears to have deflected any valid examination around this offense, and he has very little, if any, appreciation for the motivation of his actions. It goes on, he is very frustrated about what occurred and offered an analysis that was confusing, meandering, questionable, albeit mostly dishonest. And that's what was presented to the court in all three of those independent evaluations, is you have Mr. Culver who was being dishonest to those evaluators. And tying it all together with how that, you know, for example, weighs with other Trog factors. She acknowledged later on that he was present, that he attended those sessions, that he was polite. But much of that was illusory because he lied and he refused to engage with the potential for treatment or what he had done or his criminal acts. And again, at this stage in the proceedings, we're not looking to see if there are mitigating or aggravating factors. There are, and the court recognized him. We're looking to see if the court exercised its discretion in giving due consideration, deliberate consideration to those factors. And that's what this record shows. Now, specifically, it was raised on, opposing counsel raised on oral argument that he was amenable to treatment or to probation. And the district court disagreed and made a record of why it disagreed with that. So, principally, the sentencing court recognized that, you know, Mr. Culver's stepfather was there speaking on his behalf. She thanked him. She understood how difficult of a position that can be in. But the court then recognized the brutal reality of this situation is that much of this sexual abuse happened while Mr. Culver was in the care of that family. And so it wouldn't make sense to return Mr. Culver to the care of that family and that that would somehow ensure that the sexual abuse wouldn't occur. And the court was understandably concerned with that. But more to the point is that we have evidence in the independent evaluations that Mr. Culver has a daughter of his own and that he's exhibiting the same traits that precipitated all the sexual abuse with his own stepson. And again, the court is understandably uncomfortable with putting Mr. Culver back into a situation where he had an opportunity to do that, especially considering that he's exhibiting the same traits that precipitated what the child victim called his formula for sexual abuse. And finally, to the point that the record somehow shows that the district court had a clouded judgment, if your honors read the transcript and the record, it does show a court that is understandably perturbed with what's happening. She took a sharp tone at times, to be sure, but she did balance the factors. She recognized that he had appeared at all of his court appearances, at his independent evaluations, that he was polite, that he had not violated any of the terms of his conditional release. She acknowledged that he had family there supporting him. All of these are indeed mitigating factors. But it's also black letter law that the mere existence or presence of mitigating factors does not result in an obligation to depart. That's from the State v. Olson decision out of this court in 2009. The existence of mitigating factors does not require a departure. Rather, it's within the court's discretion, if it gives due consideration to those factors, to impose a presumptive sentence, which is exactly what happened here. And for the final point of whether the record supports the imposition of a presumptive sentence, I don't want to belabor the facts of this case. As opposing counsel stated, Mr. Culver raped a child. It's also much worse than that. It was over 150 times over the course of 10 years, and it was his son that he had adopted. And so without going further, the record does support the imposition of a guideline sentence. And to Judge Smith's point about the PSI, it didn't just recommend a guideline sentence, it recommended a top-of-the-box guideline sentence, which is what we have here. So you have a court reading through all of the records, hearing the testimony from the victims, and hearing oral argument from opposing counsel, and then making a decision to impose a presumptive guideline sentence. And for that reason, the state would request that this court affirm the sentence, and unless the court has any other further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Yount. Mr. Ceratori, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I just want to point out, I know that Mr. Yount pointed to Dr. Alsdorf and the denial issues that occurred in that PSE. But I also want to point out page 7 of Dr. Alsdorf's report, where he says, clinical findings around denial are well documented to not represent high likelihood to reoffend. Denial does not have an expected relationship to sexual recidivism initially proposed by those working with the sex offenders. And some studies have shown that it is high-risk offenders who express no denial. What I wanted to point out there is that you can take these little bits, microcosms, but if you look at the big picture, one of the biggest issues that Mr. Culver and what I think the court failed to recognize is that Mr. Culver was emotionally and mentally stunted, for lack of a better statement, which went to the reasons why he had issues when confronted initially and when taken bits and pieces, saying that he accepted responsibility. He accepted responsibility. He pled guilty. And during little microcosms of these reports, you will see where he admits to doing this, and then he wavers. But that is something that is accepted and anticipated with sex offenders because they are confronted with something that is as heinous as this is. So again, I think that the court did not objectively look at the factors in making its decision and therefore abuse its discretion. Thank you.
Thank you to counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days. Counsel on the fourth case may come forward and get ready. I assume they're in the attorney lounge and will come soon, but that's a good idea, Logan. No, I haven't.
Yeah, there's been thunder.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Unless I'm hearing things.